From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, our It's Just Politics team on whether Dr. Abdul El Sayed is eligible to run for governor because of where and when he's voted.
What is at issue here is a real constitutional concern.
Scientific proof that deadly Legionnaires outbreak in Flint was linked to drinking water from the Flint River.
Really, this is an unprecedented study because of the extensive data that we could draw.
Former hockey reporter Cindy Lambert with tales from the Red Wings locker room and the life of a sports journalist.
I was with the team much more than I was with my own family, more than I was even at my own office.
And Tom Brady fails to get a sixth Super Bowl win.
A very exciting game, not necessarily a well-played game. The defenses on both sides were pretty weak, a lot of bad tackling.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It has become a front-burner story in Michigan politics whether Dr. Abdul El Sayed is eligible to run for governor of Michigan, which, if successful, would make him America's first Muslim American governor. But questions about his voting record and eligibility are not going away. With us now are It's Just Politics team of Zoe Clark and Rick Pluta. Zoe, bring us all up to speed. Is this question around El Sayed's eligibility to run for governor a valid one?
Yes, this came up. We've got to give a shout out to Bridge Magazine for first kind of uncovering this issue about whether or not Abdul El Sayed is eligible to be able to run for governor under the Michigan Constitution. At issue right now is his voter registration. The Michigan Constitution says in order to run for governor, you got to be 30 years old. That is fine for Abdul El Sayed. He is 33. But you also have to have been a registered Michigan voter for 4 years. And this is where we find some trouble.
And Rick, the question does...
Article 5, Section 22.
Well, there you go, pointing to our Constitution. So does voting in another state invalidate someone's Michigan voter registration?
The answer to the first question is a definitive, we don't know.
Oh, okay.
Which, of course, makes this story even more complicated. Mm.
I checked with the Bureau of Elections, and I said, if you got word that someone had voted in another state, like if you get word that someone has a driver's license in another state, does that invalidate the Michigan registration the same way that it does the Michigan driver's license? And the issue in that is actually the interstate system for alerting Michigan secretaries of state and MDVs about driver's license just isn't as robust. So it's kind of a, you know, if a tree falls in the forest and no one is there, does it make a sound question? Could El Sayed have just returned to Michigan, resumed voting in Ann Arbor, and this wouldn't be a problem? That's what this likely challenge will probably focus on.
Just to remind everyone, he was in New York City going to school and also teaching.
Teaching and voted there in 2012.
The campaign has responded to all of this by calling it dirty politics, an effort to, by the Democratic Party establishment, air quotes here, to get rid of the more progressive candidate. And there has been talk among El Sayed supporters of racism, as they liken this to the birther attacks against former President Obama. So how is this response being received by Michigan's Democrats, Zoe?
Well, I think for some Democrats, this is a sign that this campaign is fighting back very, very hard on an issue that many, I think, would argue doesn't have to do with racism or birtherism and simply has to do whether or not this Democratic candidate crossed the T's and dotted the I's when it comes to the Michigan Constitution. They have come out very hard last week against this Bridge Magazine article, to the reporters, and then even some of Abdul's supporters, again, calling the media for folks who are bringing up this question, you know, part of just this sort of smear campaign to get Abdul El Sayed out of the race. The reporting that Rick Pluta and I have been doing, that is not the case at all. Because let me give you sort of an example, right? And this would, for the Democrats, be a worst-case example. Let's say El Sayed does win the primary, right? He's still on the ballot. Say no one charges this in court. He's still on the ballot. You can be pretty darn well sure that Republicans, after that primary, if he was on the ballot, would challenge this. And if a court does say, indeed, you are ineligible, Democrats would be left come November without a Democratic candidate on the ballot. So you can call that whether or not this is about, you know, birtherism or racism, you can claim that. But what is at issue here is a real constitutional concern.
And Rick, over the weekend, you dug into El-Sayed's claim that he would have voted in the 2016 primary election, but the lines were too long. What'd you find?
What Zoe and I found is that his defense is problematic. The church where he says he voted, two precincts vote there. They're both low turnout precincts. There were no complaints about long lines there. And in fact, very few people relative to other elections even voted there. What were our numbers, Zoe?
Well, there were a couple different precincts, but when you actually add up the numbers, it's nowhere close to the turnout when there were, you know, maybe some lines in 2012, maybe some lines in 2008. And so what it specifically came down to was, on average, maybe about 30 voters an hour.
And we talked to a few people who vote in that precinct who said that lines in the March 2016 primary in that particular church were not an issue.
But then you also found out, as far as the date of the primary and when he re-registered to vote in Michigan.
Right. At issue here is the fact that now it's come out, and this was actually other reporters who found this out, but he said he went to this Detroit polling place to vote on March 8th. At issue, though, is he was not registered. He was not registered to vote in Detroit before March 8th. He didn't register to vote in Detroit until later in March.
And he did that when he renewed his driver's license. So the question there is, what made you think you were registered in Detroit since you still had a New York driver's license and obviously hadn't done anything affirmatively to register at a Detroit address?
What are people in the Democratic Party saying about all of this?
Well, I think there's a real fear for the party heading in the 2018 election, you know, a la Bernie versus Hillary. In a lot of ways, that's what Abdul El-Sayed versus Gretchen Whitmer has sort of become in Michigan right now. You know, El-Sayed, he was a Bernie supporter, Gretchen Whitmer, you know, a Hillary supporter. I want to make this one note, though. I was in Ypsilanti for the Washtenaw County Democratic Forum on Saturday, where all four candidates running to be the Democratic candidate for governor were. And I have to tell you that the crowd there watching after the debate was lined up dozens and dozens to talk to Abdul El-Sayed. He got claps. There was genuine excitement for this candidate. And so, aside from all of these legal challenges and questions, I think the party is at this crossroads, that here is this young candidate that obviously is inspiring voters. And I get that there's a sense of, oh, is this Bernie all over again, right? That the establishment is coming in to take over this other candidate. But again, I just go back to the simple fact of, you got to cross the T's, you got to dot the I's. But this is going to mean something for the party if Abdul El-Sayed does, let's say, drop out of the race or decides, you know, not to run because of court challenges and things like that. There is going to be a group, a part of Michigan voters who are incredibly disappointed and are going to be pointing fingers whether or not it's fair.
Our It's Just Politics team of Zoe Clark and Rick Pluta. Thanks so much, guys.
You bet.
Thanks, Cindy.
Time to say hello to Michigan radio sports commentator John U. Bacon. And Tom Brady did not get that sixth Super Bowl win after all, John. What are your thoughts on Super Bowl 52?
It's a very exciting game, not necessarily a well-played game. The defenses on both sides were pretty weak, a lot of bad tackling, some funny business going on. But Tom Brady's Tom Brady. He was fun to watch throughout the whole contest. He's the real deal, man. And even though he lost, he's 5-3 in Super Bowls. Hard to feel too sorry for that guy, although he'll be back next year. You watch.
In fact, I'm hearing that today. He's saying, I'm not retiring. It is ironic. It's former Wolverines defensive end Brandon Graham who managed to sack Brady, strip the ball from his hand late in the fourth quarter. Was that moment the nail in the coffin for New England, you think?
Oh, no question it was. It was the end of the game, essentially. Pretty much.
So Wolverine on Wolverine here.
Wolverine on Wolverine. One is extraordinarily well known, of course, Tom Brady, and one Brandon Graham is not. I knew Graham quite well when I was inside the program in 08, 09. He was a junior and a senior those years. He's got an amazing story. He grew up in Detroit. His mother, the previous summer, had been mugged, and they wanted to take her purse. And as he told me, they don't know my mama, that she's going to fight you. And she fought him, and they broke her arm. And so that, Mike Barwas, the old strength coach, used the entire fall of 09 to motivate Brandon Graham. He's like, you want to get your mom a house. You want to get your mom out of here. And that, man, that guy's motor ran high. He was pretty lazy, they say, his first 2 years. And after that happened, he was on fire. And I recall watching him in 09 against Ohio State. It's the last game. They're 5-6. They're not going to make it. in the fourth quarter, I'm thinking, man, dear Lord, don't let anything happen to this guy. Because he's still out there trying to block punts and chase down quarterbacks, and the game's out of hand.
Playing his heart out.
And none of it matters at this point. I just wanted to see this guy get drafted for his own personal reasons. And of course, he was safe, and he got to Philadelphia, and he's now a captain of the team and highly regarded, and a little more highly regarded after yesterday.
They're loving him in Philadelphia.
Exactly right. Brady's going to be okay, and now Brandon Graham is a national star.
You know, it is interesting, as you say, Tom Brady, arguably the best quarterback to ever play in the NFL. If you go back 20 years to when he was playing for Michigan and battling Drew Henson for the starting job, would anyone on the team, including Coach Carr, have predicted such greatness for that young man?
Clearly not, and nor would the Patriots. I had a chance to talk to Bob Kraft, the owner of the Patriots, on the sidelines of a Michigan game years ago, and I say, you know, hey, kudos on drafting Tom Brady.
199th overall
199th
pick.
Overall, sixth round.
Yeah.
And I said, hey, kudos on drafting Tom Brady when no one else had the brains to do so. And he said, don't give us too much credit. Don't forget about blah, blah, blah. I go, who the hell is blah, blah, blah? And he said, the guy we drafted before Tom Brady. Nobody was that smart, unfortunately, on Tom Brady, but he never lost faith.
Now that Super Bowl 52 is history, Matt Patricia can make that jump from the Patriots to the Lions. So what do you think Lions fans and players are going to see from this Patriots combo of Bob Quinn and new coach Matt Patricia?
Well, the downside and the Twitter jokes and whatnot are that this guy is in charge of not the offense last night, but the defense.
Which was not so good.
Which did not have a stop against Philadelphia in the second half that I can recall.
Yeah.
So that's not very pretty. However, they got there, right? Look, for the first time in my lifetime, you have a serious general manager running the Lions. You've got a serious coach running the team. And I've never seen that in my 53 years. So, Lions fans, this is about as good as it's going to get for the foreseeable future. So this is the best chance the Lions have ever had.
Now let's head over to the Pistons briefly, where they have themselves a star new power forward, Blake Griffin, left Los Angeles, put on a Piston jersey Thursday, and scored 24 points in his debut with Detroit.
Not so bad. Look, the guy's a powerhouse, no question about it. He is a man among boys.
Yeah.
The catch is he does get injured because of it. He plays very hard, very tough.
Yeah.
So the question is, how long will you get him? Will he like Detroit? He's talking the right stuff right now.
But what are they getting in this guy as far as a player?
You're getting a bona fide first-teamer, basically, which they've lacked. It's not a star power team by any means. I think Van Gundy's done a good job, by and large, coaching this team, but it's not the roster is not is just not that strong. You now have a genuine gem in the middle of the lineup, and having a big man like that down low only helps.
Everybody's game gets elevated. I mean, hey, they beat the Grizzlies this first night, beat the Heat over the weekend. They're playing the Trailblazers tonight.
The good news is the guy plays at full energy. The bad news is because of it, he gets injured. But I'll take it.
All right. Michigan Radio's sports commentator, John Eubank. Thanks, John.
Thank you.
And late word from the Lions. It is official. Matt Patricia is the new Lions head coach, the 27th in Lions history. You're listening to Stateside. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Anybody who loves sports has probably spent time daydreaming about what it would be like to be a sports reporter, getting paid to watch games, to talk to athletes. Cynthia Lambert did that. She worked for the Detroit News, covering the Detroit Red Wings for 12 seasons, including their Stanley Cup wins in 1997 and 1998. Now she's taken those seasons of sports reporting and she's packed them into her new memoir, Power Play, My Life Inside the Red Wings Locker Room. Cindy Lambert, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
You started covering the Wings when they were the worst team in the league. Do you think you or anyone else in that locker room expected the dead Wings of 1986 to become the back-to-back Stanley Cup champs you covered in 97 and 98?
You know, it was really an evolution, and you can look at the different chapters almost in Red Wings history of that pocket of time, you know, where they hired Jacques Demers, who was a very affable coach who was very good with the media, and he won the media over. And everyone just kind of, the tide turned emotionally, I think, about the Wings. And it wasn't a hate relationship of you guys are horrible and we're never going to go see the games too. I know you guys aren't great, but you know what? We like Jacques. We like the energy. We love Steve Yzerman. We love all these new guys coming onto the team, and we can see some momentum. So I think people who started watching the Wings or really got behind them in the mid-'80s and then late-'80s you know, the fruits of that labor really paid off as they saw them steadily progress into the Stanley Cup team that we witnessed.
Yes, you certainly had a fascinating chunk of Red Wing history that spanned your career. And you started actually playing sports at a pretty tender age, as you tell us in your book, including hockey on the backyard ice rink with your brothers.
Yes, yes. You know, when you grow up on the east side of Detroit in a house that had about 1,000 square feet and a dog, of course, you had to be outside a lot. And so my dad, who was a Detroit police officer, he flooded our backyard to make an ice rink for us so that they wouldn't have to drive us to Heilman to go skating and pay for it. And sure enough, I think it was a couple weeks into it, I'm out there in my boots because I wasn't a very good skater with my figure skates that were so uncomfortable. I was checked into the fence by a neighborhood boy, and I flipped back, and then I was in the hospital with a concussion for about 2 or 3 days.
Mm-mm.
And there went the ice rink.
There you go. No more ice rink. And you did play sports even going through school. But it's interesting, you point out in your book, you don't think that growing up, even though growing up playing sports kind of eased you into the world of sports reporting, you don't think it's a must.
I don't think so. I mean, you're not playing the sport that you're covering. You're not doing a first-person story. You're there as the observer, and you're there as the investigator to find out, why did the coach play this player? Why are they, you know, I noticed this about the power play. And you're the one there, if you have the guts and if you have, you know, you can leave your ego at the door and just go into a coach's room or talk to the general manager or a scout or the player and just say, I don't understand why you did this, or why did you make that decision instead of this, or why aren't you doing this? You can get a lot of great information, and you know that from all your years of interviewing people. If you leave yourself open for possibilities, then you find out a lot more. So I think in some ways, if you go in not having a sports background, you can be a little more honest and a little more transparent, I guess, when you're asking questions. But like you said, I did play a lot of sports. I started playing softball or baseball at the age of 7. And then in high school, I lettered in 3 sports, tennis and volleyball and then softball. And I played basketball in middle school, and so there was always something, you know, frisbee in the street, golf, anything where I could get out there and move and compete.
So when you headed off to Wayne State, was sports journalism in your kind of in your sights?
I actually started out at Macomb Community mm-hmm. College, and all the tests that I took in high school said I would be great in business. Those tests are wrong. Let me tell you that. I did get my associate's in business, and I felt so frustrated, though, because I really did not enjoy what I was doing, and I thought I needed probably a gap year. So I moved out to California thinking I would continue my degree at UCLA in economics and moved in with some relatives. And after being there for about 6 months, I realized I don't want to live here. And I got the crazy idea about pursuing sports journalism because I enjoyed writing. I loved sports. I put them together. I thought, why not? And so I came back. I applied at Wayne State, got in at Wayne State, and started my career in 1985, actually, a year after I went back to Wayne State.
Everybody has that first moment in their career, no matter what it is, where you're terrified, but you've got to go do it. And what was your first, oh my goodness, I really have to do this?
That was in 1984. I was at Wayne State, and I worked also at the Northeast Detroiter, which was a free newspaper. But because it was a real newspaper, I could then get credentials to cover the Red Wings games. They had an exhibition game in Port Huron. And I drove to Port Huron, and I'm going to cover this game, and it was going to be my first time in the locker room. And I knew I could do it. This is part of the job. If you can't go in the locker room, you can't cover sports because that's where all the interviews are done. So I psyched myself up, and I'm sitting in the press box, and my stomach is churning, and I'm getting so nervous. I'm thinking, what's it going to be like? I didn't know anyone else who was a sports reporter. So I couldn't ask, you know, what's the scene going to be like? Is it going to be calm? Are they going to hate me? Are they going to ignore me? What's going to happen? So I walk into the locker room, and it's total chaos. And I thought, this is not a private atmosphere at all. So I was a little relieved. But there, you know, it was really kind of an intimidating environment. But I was doing some of the interviews. I was doing okay. I'm like, you're doing fine, Cindy. You're going to make it out of this alive. And then Sean Burr, who was a draft pick that year, he was 18 years old, comes out of the shower with a towel wrapped around him, takes one look at me, and shrieks. It never occurred to me that a player would be afraid of me. And that just, everything fell apart at that point. I almost collapsed. Kevin Allen, who's with USA Today to this day, he couldn't stop laughing. And he came up to me and he just said, I have never seen anything that funny again or ever. And we chatted for a little bit. I did a couple more interviews. His teammates led Sean away to the safety of his little stall
Gave
area.
Him smelling salts.
Yes, tried to calm him down, which anyone who knew Sean knew that his mouth ran at a million miles an hour. So I know he said a lot of stuff, but we became friends through the years, and it was a funny thing to laugh at.
And you were a rare bird in the mid-'80s. Today, I suspect, you know, just watch sports on TV, and there are women everywhere. Was not the case what the time we're talking about when you were starting your career.
No, there weren't many women at all. There was, in Detroit, there was Ann Doyle, who was on TV. At the Free Press, Jeanette Howard had started there, but, you know, she was with the Free Press. She covered Olympics and basketball, and our paths never crossed. And when they did, it was nice to be able to chat with her. But no, I was pretty much on my own. And then when I started traveling with the Wings, though, I got to meet some of the reporters in the other cities, like Helene Elliott and Sherry Ross in New York, and Cammy Clark down in Tampa, and Karen Krause out in California, and Nancy Marapiece in Boston. There were several, but again, still a very small percentage. But all, and I don't know, maybe other female reporters are like this in other specialty areas, I guess you'd say, but they were all so nice. We all got along great.
The sisterhood.
It really was.
Although you say you don't consider yourself a feminist, you consider yourself an equalist.
Yes, yes. Meaning. I think, you know, I just always, growing up even, I mean, I had three brothers. I had to fight for my rights in that house. And I had a real, I think I was born with it, a real strong sense of you don't just do something because you're a girl, or you don't just get allowed to do something because you're a boy. And I challenged that one night at our dinner table. My brothers, asked my dad if he would play pickle with them after dinner. That's, you know, running bases. And I was so excited because my dad was always busy. He worked a part-time job painting houses and, you know, a cop. And I was so excited. And my brother John laughed at me and said, ha, you have to clean the kitchen, because that was my job every night because I was the girl. They would help my dad mow the lawn once a week. And there were three of them. They would rotate. So maybe once a month they would have a job to do, you know, among taking out the trash or whatever. So I contested it. And I spoke my mind. And my dad just laughed. And I said, it's not fair that, you know, I have to do this every night. And my dad kind of chuckled. And my mom put her fork down and said, she's right. From now on, Jerry and John, you clean it one night. Steve and Cindy, you clean it the other. We're going to divide this equally now. So I think that's where the little water was poured on that seed.
I'm speaking with former Detroit News hockey writer Cindy Lambert. Her memoir is Power Play, My Life Inside the Red Wings Locker Room. So thinking of the years you covered the Wings from the mid-'80s to the back-to-back Stanley Cup winning seasons in 97 and 98, you had a lot of personalities you covered. So give us a quick memory about Coach Scotty Bowman.
Oh, tough. Scotty is one of the most complicated human beings I've ever encountered in my life. One minute you think that you've got a great relationship and he's being honest and you're having a great dialogue and you had a great interview, and the next day he won't look at you, or the next day he tells you, oh, Chris Osgood's going to be in goal, and then Mike Vernon comes out as the goalie. So there was a constant off balance with Scotty.
Steve Yzerman.
Oh. Total class. I am so grateful to this day, and I think the perspective I've had over the last 20 years after I left the paper has helped me appreciate Steve Yzerman more. For at his age, when he became captain of that team, in a city like Detroit where it's very focused on sports, I never had a bad experience with Steve Yzerman. Interviewing him, if he had an issue with something I wrote, he would walk up to me, look me in the eye, speak his piece very respectfully, open it up for dialogue. We could agree, we could disagree. He could persuade me, I could persuade him. but there was never any lingering animosity or passive aggressiveness. He was just complete class. And you cannot ever underestimate the impact Steve Yzerman had on that team. And he is one of the, obviously, the main reason they ended up winning those cups.
Vladimir Konstantinov.
Vladdy. You know, he was, I remember watching him before he came to the Wings, thinking, oh my God, look at that guy skate. Look at how mean he is. And then I saw him after, and he was scary looking to me. You know, gaunt and those high cheekbones, and, you know, obviously didn't speak any English, and everything seemed to come out so gruff. Then I got to know him, and his sense of humor was beautiful. And really just, I almost felt like he was almost a little afraid. You know, he was this enormous talent, but he kept to himself, and he would just sit and observe. And it broke my heart with that accident, that and accident. I it yeah. still does to this day.
Bob Probert.
Oh, I loved Bob. Obviously, you know, here I am saying I love all these players. They were just great people to work with. Bob Probert was such a good person, and he had a horrible affliction. And
of addiction, yeah.
Yes, yes. And he was a warrior. I mean, he fought this disease and the demons that were inside him, and sometimes he won and sometimes he didn't. But like Steve Yzerman, Bob Probert, and this may surprise people, but I never had harsh words with Bob Probert, even with the stuff I had to write about him and the questions I had to ask him. He never came at me and showed anger toward me, and I always tried to be fair to him, and I think maybe in some ways I was probably a little soft covering him because I just recognized how much of a challenge his whole life probably was because of the stuff he had to deal with. But amazing player, and loved to watch him fight.
He was.
I loved it.
What is something about the sports reporter's life people would be shocked to know?
I think the loneliness. I was with the team much more than I was with my own family, more than I was even at my own office. In fact, during the middle of covering the Wings, at some point after 5 or 6 years, I was told, come and clear your desk out at the office. We need someone to use that. Just work out of your house. So I was around all these people who were more like my colleagues, you know, Keith Primeau and Sergei Fedorov. They were my colleagues, Jacques Demers, Scotty Bowman, Brian Murray. But they weren't. It felt like they were, but they really weren't. They were my subjects, and I had to cover them. And so I had to keep a distance. And at that point, I was the only woman. For a while, Viv Bernstein came and covered the Wings for the Free Press. And we hung out a little bit. That felt, you know, comfortable to do. But otherwise, I was pretty much on my own when we were on the road. And when we were home, it was great. But on the road, until I made friends in the different cities, I was pretty much on my own.
So you called it a career after that second Stanley Cup win. Did going through the process of writing this book and digging through memories and unpacking all that, did it make you ever kind of think, yeah, maybe I do miss it?
Not a single bit. In fact, that was one of the things that surprised me the most when I left. And I was immersed in my career. I loved my job. But I knew that last year I couldn't keep up this pace. I wanted to have a family. I wanted a little bit more of a different type of life. And I knew my personality. There are women and men who still cover hockey, baseball, football, basketball, have families. They're fine. I wasn't one of those people. I knew I couldn't do that. It was tough, and it took a long time and a lot of soul searching and a lot of, you know, pros and cons and all this, and I overthought it. But once I decided and I gave my notice in November of 98, I walked away and I didn't even have the desire to go to a game. I thought, oh my gosh, what happened? How long has this been going on? But there were just other areas of my life that opened up. And soon I had a child, and then I was watching, you know, Blue's Clues and getting up at 4:35 in the morning and going to bed at 8 o'clock at night. So
do you go to games now?
You know, I just went to a game a couple weeks ago. They played Tampa Bay, mm-hmm. and they lost. But it was a great game. There were a lot of fights. Got to see Steve Yzerman on the Jumbotron. I don't think they call it a Jumbotron anymore. They don't even call it a game anymore. They say, welcome to the show. That kind of rubbed me the wrong way. I don't like that at all. It's a game, people.
It's a game. Well, the book is really a fun read. A lot of insider good stuff. And as you say, well, I'm not here to be salacious. I'm here to kind of tell you what it's like to be inside the Red Wings locker room. And you did a beautiful job. Power Play by Cynthia Lambert. It was great talking with you. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you so much. It was great talking with you.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. Coming up on The Next Idea, we'll check back in with the creator of the app Animo, described as Yelp for migrant farm workers.
People are just really genuinely willing to help entrepreneurs, and especially, you know, when it comes to innovative ideas that also have a social impact and that are so critical like this for Michigan.
And then new information about the Flint water crisis as we learn the majority of Legionnaires' cases in Genesee County in 2014 and 2015 can be linked to the switch to the Flint River. We'll be right back. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty.
Experimentation.
Vision.
The next idea.
People mean very different things whenever they talk about innovation.
After more than 3 years on the air, our innovation series, The Next Idea, is coming to a close. So it seemed like a good time to check back in with one of the many contributors to the series. Feliciano Paredes is a classic example of an entrepreneur who sees a need, creates an invention to fill that need, and then sets out on the journey to bring that invention to market. Back in November 2016, we talked to him about a phone app he was creating called Animo, described as Yelp for migrant farm workers.
It's been an ongoing story for many years that labor just is very difficult to find, and farmers are trying everything from mechanization to third-party recruiters, contractors, trying to find the labor to harvest these crops that need to be hand-harvested. And definitely farmers that I've talked to were very eager to be able to put their profile or their farm on an application that, thousands and maybe even millions of farm workers would be using to locate help, to be able to provide that platform where the farmer and the agency and the farm worker can connect.
Well, plenty of things have happened since we talked in November 2016, and Feliciano joins us now to talk about the journey. Feliciano, welcome back to The Next Idea.
Thank you.
So remind us again, exactly what does the app do?
So essentially, it's a marketplace for the agricultural industry, so where agriculture employers can create profiles, post jobs to connect with workers that are looking for agricultural work. They could be workers that are here in Michigan, for example, or maybe workers that are in other states, maybe interested in coming to Michigan to work for the season. In addition to that, we also provide a support system for the workers and the growers through a directory that's also included in the app.
Well, let's talk about what's happened since November 2016. First off, it looks like you changed the name of the app.
Yeah, we ended up changing the name just to go with something a little bit more people could, I guess, relate to or recognize. So we've changed it to Ag Help, and that's what the name is now. We're just kind of working on finishing up the trademark for the name and the symbol for it.
And then what about getting it out there and being used?
Yeah, so we're still working with our minimum viable product that came out of the assistance with Grand Valley State University. So right now we're in the next phase of our development where we're actively seeking either investment or opportunities to connect with resources that can take us from the minimum viable product phase into developing the app with Android on Apple and in Spanish, which is one of the really key things that we want to do.
Now, that term minimum viable, what is, that sounds like something that developers use, but the public maybe doesn't know what that term means.
Right. So minimum viable product is just kind of our first version of the app. So what we're doing with this version is we're getting it out to growers, support agencies, and workers in order to get feedback on kind of what they like, things that aren't working properly, or different features that they would hope to see in a version that growers especially would be willing to pay for, because ultimately that's the market that will be paying for it are the growers, and of course that will be free for support agencies and workers.
You know, Feliciano, the current climate around issues of immigration, deportation, et cetera, we are hearing that fewer migrant workers are coming to the U.S. Is that at all affecting your plans for this app?
Not so much. I think IRCA, I think it's the Immigration Reform Act, I think of 1986, will always put the due diligence to, I guess, verify whether a worker is authorized to work in the U.S. Onto the employer. That's a federal regulation. So what we're focused on is really just providing more transparency in the agricultural recruitment process. One, making sure that workers that are connecting with growers, that they have the resources and that the growers have enough labor to be able to harvest their crops.
So it sounds like it could be more important than ever. If there are fewer people coming, people are going to really want to get those job opportunities up on the app so they get people coming to fill them.
Right, yeah. We see that as kind of and we may not be able to maybe bring in more workers through, you know, an app like this, but just to be able to maximize the available labor that's in the area, because right now it's workers are finishing up and they're kind of wondering where to go next, whereas a tool like this, they'd be able to continue working, you know, throughout the season, maybe stay in the state longer, and just maximize the available labor that's here in Michigan or you know, across the country.
Through this journey you've been on now for a few years, mm-hmm. as an app developer, as an entrepreneur, what's been the biggest surprise for you?
Probably the biggest surprise is just the amount of support that's available out there for entrepreneurs. One of the organizations that we've been working with very closely is Grand Valley's Small Business Development Center, and they provide free resources for entrepreneurs, and they've just been really instrumental. So one, the resources on this side of the state, and then in Detroit, east side, the resources for entrepreneurs out there is just tremendous. People are just really genuinely willing to help entrepreneurs, and especially, you know, when it comes to innovative ideas that also have a social impact and that are so critical like this for Michigan.
And so what was once ANIMO is now, once again, the new name is?
Ag Help.
All right. Well, you're continuing the journey of developing that. We wish you a lot of luck, Feliciano, and we want to thank you so much for being a part of The Next Idea.
Well, thanks for the opportunity. Appreciate it.
All The Next Idea interviews are archived at michiganradio.org.
Support for The Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
Researchers have linked that deadly Legionnaire's disease outbreak in Genesee County to the switch to the Flint River for drinking water. The Flint Area Community Health and Environment Partnership conducted two studies. Michelle Swanson was lead researcher in both studies, and she spoke with Stateside's Lester Graham.
Okay, so to remind people, 12 people died, dozens more, about 78 people became sick during these Legionnaire's disease outbreaks in 2014 and 15. Your teams found the majority of the Legionnaire's disease cases in Genesee County can be attributed to the water supply switch. How do you know this was because of the Flint water switch?
So that's a great question. We were fortunate that we had several large data sets. Really, this is an unprecedented study because of the extensive data that we could draw. So we were able to work with our partners at the state health department and get records on all of the Legionnaires' cases in Flint, in Genesee County, Oakland County, and Wayne County over a six-year period. And then we also obtained information from the water. Utilities are obligated to sample the water once a week at eight different places in Flint and test different parameters, including chlorine. So we have 4 years of chlorine data, weekly chlorine data. And we also have another data set asking how many people that live in surrounding neighborhoods commute into the city of Flint. And we, in this case, really is Sammy Zarin. He's a professor of economics out at Colorado State and also heads up their risk assessment unit. And he was able to apply statistical tests to ask whether the change in water, if we could infer it was the cause of the increase in Legionnaires' disease.
Okay, so let's take that a step at a time.
Sure. Then.
Why three counties? Are the other counties like control groups?
Exactly.
Okay.
So we were able to compare two parameters before the switch and after the switch, and then in Flint or in Genesee County, but not Flint. And we can do pairwise comparisons and then generate really robust statistical data that points to the amount of chlorine in the water. The more you have, the less risk of Legionnaires' disease appearing in that neighborhood.
Right. Chlorine is a disinfectant.
It
takes care of a lot of the pathogens in water. So if it's down a little, that means there's more chances of some of these germs still staying in the water.
That's what the patterns show, yes.
Okay. Back to the switch to the Flint water supply.
Mm-hmm.
This was a timeline you were able to follow because of all this data and say, okay, look, this is where our spike was, and now we've assumed that might have something to do with it. How did you determine that you're absolutely sure that the bulk of the Legionnaires' cases were due to that switch?
Right. Well, you can imagine we had a very large data set, eight different locations around the city of Flint over a four-year period, weekly chlorine measurements. And so when Flint was getting their water from the Lake Huron, all the chlorine measurements were very tightly tracking. And then once they switched to the Flint River, the numbers became chaotic. So some regions in the city had very high chlorine levels, others had very low, and others bounced from high to low to medium. So we can take that, and we know what the chlorine concentration was in a particular neighborhood at a particular time, and then layer on top of that, who got Legionnaires' disease, where do they live, and when did they get disease, and what was the chlorine concentration when they would have been exposed. And so when you take those 4 years of data, you get a very clear relationship that more chlorine, less likely to get disease in your neighborhood.
Now, you found that the majority of the Legionnaires' cases were caused by this switch. There are a few Legionnaires' cases every year. How do you determine whether some of them were or some of them were not connected to that switch in water sources?
Right. So again, it's a statistical argument, but we can look at our neighboring control communities and see how many cases they typically get in a year. We can also look at Flint. How many cases did they typically have in the years before the switch? And how many cases do they have now after they've switched back to Lake Huron and the water system has healed? And we're getting low baseline levels, but that spike in Legionnaires' cases that corresponded with the chaotic chlorine is now gone.
One of the concerns was somehow this was associated with McLaren Hospital. Does this clear McLaren Hospital now from any kind of problems? They just happen to have the same source of water everybody else did?
So our data don't try to tease that apart, but what we did do was with the hundreds of Legionnaires' cases that we had in our database, we were able to look at the medical records and subtract out, remove any person that had an association with McLaren, if they were a patient there or visited there. And even when we remove any patient that had an exposure to McLaren, we still see this relationship between chlorine and risk of disease. So the two models are not mutually exclusive, but we can say confidently that the McLaren outbreak is not sufficient to account for all the disease.
So you had two studies. Do these things overlap to lead you to these conclusions, or did the second study have a different goal?
It's really a separate study. What brought them together is we had an interdisciplinary team that was approaching this problem from many different angles. So the second study was an opportunity to go in and sample water from hundreds of homes in Flint and in neighboring communities and ask, is there Legionella in the water? How frequent? What kind of Legionella? So we found about 12% of the homes in Flint and 12% of the homes in our control areas had Legionella 1 year after the switch back to Lake Huron when the outbreak had dissipated. So what was interesting is we found that the type of Legionella in homes is really distinct from the kind that is detected in the hospitals. So fortunately, we have a really good diagnostic test for Legionnaire's disease. You can pee in a cup and then test the urine for the presence of a particular antigen. And so we have a cheap, fast, reliable, sensitive test for picking up one type of Legionella, serogroup 1. And in fact, that's been the cause of some 80% of disease worldwide. What's curious is we found serogroup 6 Legionella in people's homes. Serogroup 6 would not be detected by this common diagnostic test, but in the clinical literature, we know that serogroup 6 can cause disease in humans. And in our laboratory studies, we see that the serogroup 6 and the clinical serogroup 1 strains from patients in Southeast Michigan are indistinguishable. They're both able to get into white blood cells and replicate there. So we can't say that they're not a risk.
Tell me about the Flint Area Community Health and Environmental Partnership. Who put that together and why?
Yeah, so that was actually an initiative from our state, from the Michigan Department of Health and Human Services. They reached out to my colleague, Sean McMurray, who is at Wayne State, who's an environmental engineer, and he and his research team have been working in Flint since I think about 2010. So he had a long relationship already there. And he was asked to recruit a interdisciplinary team that could go into Flint, regain the trust of the people there, and begin to collect data. Basically, the motivation was, let's not let any good crisis go to waste. Let's go in and investigate, squeeze as much information as we can out of the Flint water crisis so that hopefully we can apply that knowledge to better public policies. So we were able to recruit Flint citizens to work at our field station in Flint and help us with the surveillance campaign. And also many, many residents opened their doors to us so that we could go in and collect water samples and begin to try to understand what happened. So we really appreciate the cooperation and collaboration with the people of Flint in this study.
Now, you've established that there is a connection, there is a link, a definitive link between the switch to Flint water and the majority of these Legionnaire's disease outbreaks in 14 and 15. I want to point out that these studies were peer-reviewed and published in academic journals, the Proceeding of the National Academy of Sciences, and is it MBio? Is that what it is?
That's right, which is a journal of the American Society for Microbiology.
Remind us why peer review is important.
Since the beginning of time, academic scientists have relied on each other to vet each other's work, to really study it carefully and provide feedback to the authors, anonymous feedback, on perhaps gaps in their logic or something that's not explained well, and also are they being true to the literature that's already out there. So the typical pattern is that a research group will submit to a journal. An editor will then select experts in that field, send it out for anonymous review, and then the authors get the critiques back and often have to do more experiments, change the language, etc. So it turns out to be a very rigorous and sometimes painful, but very useful process.
But the bottom line is your findings that these 12 deaths, these 78 sicknesses, are connected to the Flint water switch. This has been verified by another group of academics.
The methods have been verified to be accurate, and it is.
And one assumes the conclusions then.
Right.
That is Michelle Swanson. She's a professor of microbiology and immunology at the University of Michigan Medical School. Thanks for coming in and telling us about this.
My pleasure.
T
Today's Stateside was directed by Ellie Billings and engineered by Bob Scon. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mike Blank, Danny Hensel, Mercedes Mejia, and Lindsay Scullin. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.